Welcome to the Visceral Voice Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Schneider. Every 2 weeks on this podcast, I talk with voice specialists, manual therapists, health specialists, psychotherapists, movement practitioners, and professional voice users about voice science, function, medication, movement, puberty and aging, and everything in between. I am on a quest not only to become a better manual therapist, but also to learn everything I can about the living, breathing body and its intricate connection to the voice. This podcast documents the continuation of my learning and my experience as a professional singer, a nutritional consultant, and a manual therapist. Join me every 2 weeks as we strive to provide current, knowledgeable, creative, and compassionate information to help restore, regain, and create happiness and success in your vocal journey. Hey everyone, I just wanted to make a quick announcement that the Visceral Voice website is now live. Please come and join us at www.theviscervoice.com and check it out. We have a ton of new classes. So we'll have workshops with some of the master teachers that you hear on the podcast, as well as other offerings, courses, anatomy courses that I am teaching, self-care classes and courses that I am teaching, as well as coming soon, manual therapy courses for speech language pathologists, as well as manual therapists. So please pop on, join us at thevisceralvoice.com, www.thevisceralvoice.com, and check it out. If you want to receive newsletters on upcoming information, please go ahead and subscribe, and then you will get all of the events. Anytime there's a new event coming or a new workshop coming with one of the master teachers, I send out a news blast. So that will help you get that news blast. If you are willing and interested in becoming a supporter of the Visceral Voice podcast to help the continuation of this podcast, please make a donation at the link provided in the show notes, the Patreon link provided in the show notes. I really appreciate your support in helping me maintain and continue the podcast. As always, thank you all so much for listening, and I look forward to seeing you at www.thevisceralvoice.com.
On today's episode, Christine and I are interviewing Ingela Onstadt. Now, this is Ingela's second episode with the Visceral Voice podcast. Ingela is the founder and creator of Courageous Artistry, which empowers artists to deal with their anxiety and their challenges on taking the stage. Ingela is a professional opera singer, a licensed mental health counselor, and she is a board-certified anxiety life coach. She has presented on performance anxiety at a variety of universities across the country at NATS, and we are so thrilled to have her here today to talk about what it's going to be like after the pandemic for these artists to take the stage.
Hello, and welcome back to the podcast. I am so excited about today's podcast because not only do we have the return of an extraordinary guest and the closer of our season three, but also this is our first episode with my co-host, Kimberly Doreen Burns. So thank you both so much for being here. I'm very excited to have this interview with both of you.
Yes, me too. I am so excited to join you today, Christine, as your co-host. What a wonderful first episode we have planned, and I'm so excited to be talking with. Let's actually get the tea on your name. Is it because you know I've heard it a few different ways, and I want to make sure our listeners know. Is it Ingela? Ingela? Let us know.
It is Ingela, and I always tell people it rhymes with sing, and I'm also a singer. So if you just think of sing, it's Ingela, and it's a Norwegian name. So I know a lot of people see it, and they want to pronounce it like Angela. So that's a very common thing to have happen. I'm always happy to correct people and or explain it again. It never offends me.
That's perfect. I'm glad we clarified my name on my first episode. So now we'll clarify your name. And this way we'll know moving forward. So Ingela, I am so thrilled through Christine to be connected with you. We've already emailed back and forth a little bit, and and I know we feel a kinship, you know, like kindred spirits together. And I just want to sing your praises for a hot second and just say, you know, I suffered for 6 years from performance anxiety. I know my dear friend Christine here also suffered a bit. And I just think what you're doing is so remarkable. And I hope people seek you out because I felt so alone. And I'm thrilled that you're doing what you're doing for these artists.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you very much. And you know what? Actually, people have sought me out after and have mentioned that they heard me on The Visceral Voice. So, hey, it's already working.
That's so great. All right. Let's get into some questions. I was listening, and I think Christine did too. We were listening to your first interview, and you had said in your first interview that you never considered yourself an anxious person in your life. And I feel the same way. I was never considered, you know, anxious or nervous. I never had any stage fright or performance anxiety. And mine came out of nowhere, like a train just barreling down on me. So we are talking today about how performers are going to navigate taking the stage again, and going to auditions and performances after being through this pandemic and being isolated in their homes. So I am curious, Ingela, a lot of these performers maybe have never experienced anxiety before. Do you predict that a lot of these performers will suddenly become anxious out of nowhere?
Yeah. And, you know, it's always interesting hearing people's stories like yours, Kimberly, or like yours, Christine. I think that this sort of stems from maybe a problem that we don't have a broad enough scope of how to actually define anxiety in the first place, especially in the arts. I think people say, oh, well, I don't have stage fright, or I'm not nervous in performances, and so therefore I'm not anxious. So I always like to clarify that, you know, anxiety is just sort of one of the many flavors or shades of fear, and it can show up in so many ways. So, you know, thinking back on my own experience, yeah, I didn't have the typical stage fright symptoms. However, I, you know, of course, experienced some nervousness or agitation in, let's say, auditions. I didn't have it within sort of my personal identity that I am an anxious person or that I am an anxious singer. And I think that that is because we view it very narrowly. And if we could sort of widen our view on what anxiety is or what fear is and how it might show up in our lives, you know, it might be the physical symptoms that everybody knows about, and that's what where everybody's brain sort of tends to go first. But I think more often it can be rooted in a lot of limiting thoughts or beliefs about ourselves, about the profession, about the world, about relationships, about what have you. It may show up as procrastination. It may show up as extreme perfectionism. So I would say that even if a person maybe heretofore hadn't thought of themselves as anxious, really it's impossible as a human being to not ever have anxiety. So we all experience it. And then of course, what I've been saying to a lot of my clients is that the pandemic has really highlighted our lack of control that we have in general in our lives. This was always true, I like to point out, but the pandemic has just made it that much more real. So we never knew what was coming next. We actually never knew if we were going to perform well in that performance or audition or not, right? Because we don't know the future. A lot of things can happen. We had our whole careers planned out, and then suddenly the pandemic brought things to a screeching halt. So I would say, though, overall, that my gut instinct is that likely more people will be experiencing higher levels of overall anxiety in their lives, and this may show up more in their performing lives, right? A lot of people I know have been asking the question, should I stay in this career? Will it exist? For example, will Broadway ever open back up again? What's going to happen there? And what's also interesting is that I find that my clients, my psychotherapy clients, who were sort of maybe more anxious and seeking therapy for anxiety purposes prior to the pandemic, many of them have reflected to me, and of course this is, you know, just anecdotal evidence here, that they actually are doing better in the pandemic because suddenly everybody else is also anxious. They're not the only ones anymore, or they don't perceive themselves to be the only ones anymore. So me and my colleagues are finding that a lot of our more anxious clients are actually coping with the pandemic pretty well because they're sort of thinking like, oh, well, finally, everybody else is as anxious as I am, which is probably very calming for them. Yeah, but I do think that there will be people that during this time and this break, a lot of other anxieties have come up in their lives, and that's going to bleed into our performing lives. There's just no way around it.
Kimberly and I had discussed several weeks ago when we decided we wanted to put this podcast interview together, what will it be like to return in person in an audition room and in person on stage, and not just the anxieties of what's been going on in the last several months and the last 6 months, but what will it be like to suddenly be in front of people auditioning again, or in front of people performing again? And will there be anxieties? You know, there's already, I think, many of us have a very different feel with an audition than we do with an actual live performance. Mm-hmm. So suddenly walking into a room without a mask,
right,
with people sitting behind a table, and suddenly we're in this smaller room with other people, and we haven't been that way in a while. What is that aspect going to be like?
Oh, yeah, I think that is going to add a lot of complication to our suffering with anxiety and fear. I mean, I know for myself, when I'm out in public, I live in New Mexico, and we have had our governor's been highly active in closing everything down and being very conservative about how she treats the virus. So I have not been out in public very much. You know, everybody here for the most part is wearing masks and has been the whole time. So I find now that I'm venturing into public a little bit more often as the numbers here continue to decrease. Yeah, that just something that used to be so normal, like sitting outside on a patio at a restaurant, is suddenly fraught with all of these complications that you didn't think about before, or I'm sitting there and I'm eating my food and my mask is off and I'm noticing people around me, you know, even if they are 6 feet away with their masks off, or somebody coughs and you think something. So, right, just our very existence, right, our health, our well-being, our ability to stay healthy and alive has been incredibly threatened. And I think for many people, especially people who've maybe never coped with any type of devastating illness before, this is perhaps their first taste of what it is like to fear for your life in terms of your health. And that's just an enormous strain for all of us to cope with. So I can only imagine, going into an audition or into a performance, even under the best conditions, just being near your other colleagues. And, I have a couple coaching clients right now who are in performance situations, some abroad, and right, they get COVID tests every week and they're still singing around people. Of course, it's more limited, but, we singers are what are referred to, we've all heard it, we're the super spreaders, super sprayers, right? I think that this is really going to add a whole new dimension to things that was never there before. So if you didn't have great coping strategies for things like this before, now is really the time to be thinking about it.
Yeah, thank you. And speaking of coping strategies, what are some basic coping strategies that performers could use before they go to their first audition or have their first performance? How can they prepare?
Yeah. In my first episode with you, we talked a lot about different strategies and different ways people can cope. And those were sort of maybe more global suggestions that people could consider adding to their lives. But if I'm thinking kind of through the lens of a person has an audition coming up very soon and what are some like very specific tools that they could use, I would really urge that person, you know, from the minute they hear about this, to really sit down and think about why we are doing this. Why are we in the arts? Why are we going to this audition? Why is it that we are pursuing our craft? And really exploring, maybe through journaling or talking about it with a loved one, what is important to us about this and what keeps us here? Because, you know, we've all heard it many times, like from mentors and teachers and other people in the community. For a lot of people that, you know, they hear that old adage, well, if you can think of doing anything else with your life and that sounds pleasurable to you, then please go do it, because this is a hard path to follow. It has a lot of complications. It can be very intense. It is not for the faint of heart. And so I'm assuming that if somebody's going back to an audition, they are one of those people who says, I must do this at all costs. So really maybe exploring, what does this mean to me? I know for myself, for example, when I was pursuing and in a full-time singing career, really what was so important to me was that feeling of being a vessel for something greater for the audience. Mm-hmm. And that feeling that if I've just maybe touched one or two people that evening, then that's worth it to me. If I have provided one or two people in the audience with a few moments of escape or a connection to something higher than ourselves, or, you know, something maybe more, a more divine experience, then that is what was important to me. So I think getting really clear on our why is so powerful, because in moments of doubt and fear, we can go back to that and we can say, no, this is really so important to me for these reasons. This is why I stay committed, because it's going to be really easy right now for people to question, do I want to be doing this? So I would say that would be sort of a pre-coping mechanism. But then I think so often when we are going into any performance, or I know especially audition situations, we're so focused on all of the things that we don't want to have happen. We're so focused on, oh, that moment or that note or that rhythm or that entrance, I hope that doesn't go wrong. Oh my gosh. And of course, we spend so much time in our studies fixing problems, you know, really, and receiving criticism. And that's part of, you know, going to lessons and school and all of that. But I would say sitting down and making visualization of how you want to feel, how you want it to go, how you want the entire performance to go, the entire audition, and really allowing yourself to kind of make it better than your wildest dreams. Because I find that when I do this visualization exercises with clients, I have to chuckle every time, because they get so modest about it. Like, oh, I guess I would just be happy if it just sort of went, you know, kind of well. And people get so kind of sad about it. I'm like, really, people? I mean, if we're visualizing, why not make it as big as you possibly can? But, you know, it just shows me kind of how weak all of our visualization muscles are. And then some breathing exercises that I really like are one that I call the snake breath, which is just a very, 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 very easy inhale, you know, preferably kind of feeling it in the belly, and then hissing or puffing or sort of blowing out the air, but, you know, restricting the aperture. So I like the hiss because it automatically restricts the aperture. Any type of breathing exercise we do that has an exhale that is twice as long as the inhale is going to activate our parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system responsible for the rest and digest. And it's the counterbalance to the fight or flight, which is the sympathetic nervous system. I also really like the 4-7-8 breath for that reason, you know, which is four counts inhale, seven counts hold, eight counts exhale. And doing these many times in a row when we are agitated is going to really guarantee that we will feel calmer. There's no way around it. With a couple, you know, little tips added in there. When you first start the 4-7-8 breath, if you are feeling really agitated, count quickly. Don't try to go, you know, one Mississippi, two Mississippi, because you're going to feel very stressed while doing that. So counting very quickly while doing the 4-7-8 breath. I would say using something like a five senses meditation, where we are just becoming more mindful in the moment. Like I envision somebody sitting in the audition room, or the room leading up to the audition, in that terrible waiting period that we all detest so much, with so many people around and all of this nervous energy, but really focusing on what do I see right now, and naming that to ourselves. What do I hear right now? And really focusing on all the different kinds of things we can hear. Focusing on what do we smell? What do we, feel in terms of our sense of touch? Can we taste anything? That's a great mindful strategy to help people who are feeling very anxious. I also think that any type of maybe doing some type of breathing exercise where you're focusing on an alternate nostril breathing, doing a snake breath. So taking that inhale and hissing out the exhale. But when you do so, inhaling through the nose, but trying to do it so that you are paying attention more to one nostril as you inhale and then to the other nostril. So meaning like I'm going to pay attention to my right nostril as I do my inhale right now. I'm going to hiss out my exhale. And then I'm going to pay attention to inhaling through the left nostril and just tuning into those sensations. And then, of course, our self-care. If we do not have our self-care on point, and I talk to performers every day, and man, it never surprises or fails to surprise me just how poor we all are at taking good care of ourselves in terms of basic things like rest, exercise, good nutrition, healthy coping strategies overall, reduced use of substances, engaging in hobbies that are fun, watching our social media, not having our diet be so filled with social media. I know that's probably, I've gone off on all of my coping strategies right now, but those are some basic ones that I think people could tune into pretty quickly without having to have a lot of prior knowledge of them.
Yeah. Just listening to this list, it's so reaffirming because these are all things that that I use in my studio for my students, just in my limited research of, coping mechanisms when I was going through my own performance anxiety and stage fright. These are all things that I use that have really, really worked. The visualization and the hissing breath. And I love what you said about remembering why we do this, remembering the love and the calling to the stage, right? And just reminding ourselves that we are here because there's nothing else we love more on this earth. And I just always try to remind, my clients of that, even myself. And I think that that is going to be a really helpful tip for everybody to just remember that it is a calling, and we're there because we love it,
I love, actually, you mentioned all the self-care as well. And in my self-care membership, I'm doing a lot of exactly what you said, the 4-7-8, which is my favorite relaxation breath, the sense meditations, alternate nostril breathing, all of it. So just to recap for the listeners, Ingela just mentioned getting clear on our why, visualization. She mentioned several breathing, a snake breath with an inhale and a hiss out, a 4-7-8 breath, five senses meditation or recognition, and alternate nostril breathing. So thank you so much for those coping strategies.
Yeah. And just to add, Kimberly, I listened to your episode with Christine, and I know, Christine, you have your self-care membership. There are so many tools out there, and I always kind of tell people when they first come to me, I don't have any magic to share with you. There's nothing magical about this. All of this information is out there in the world. I am not like hoarding any tips that I only give to people who pay me to work with me. But what is so interesting about it is almost our, I don't want to use the word refusal, but almost our refusal to help ourselves in these ways, and our feeling, and I think this is instilled in us through our culture and our schooling system and all of this, that there's this fallacy that if we just practice more and get better, we'll become less anxious. And I know that both of you know that is absolutely not true. In fact, more performers, I find, experience higher levels of anxiety later on. So, for those of you out there who are still maybe in the younger side of your profession, do not harbor the disbelief that if you just get better and you just obsess about your high notes or your belt technique or whatever it may be, that magically your anxiety will go away. You know, yes, of course, get support. Practice. Make sure you are really, 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 really well prepared at auditions and shows and everything else. Put that time in that you need to put in order to feel prepared. But, you know, it's about exploring what are the barriers that we all have to our own well-being and taking care of ourselves in those ways.
Yeah, that blew my mind when you guys had talked in your previous interview about how anxiety got worse as we got, you know, at higher levels of performance and we got older. That was so true for me. You know, it was when I started working bigger shows in bigger theaters, and I never saw that coming. And I love that, you know, you sort of brought up these younger artists, because I do work with a lot of teenagers right now who are feeling lots of pressures auditioning for college. They're going to school over their computers, over Zoom, and using their iPads and their phones, and they rely so much on machinery, and they've also been isolated this entire time. Yet they're performers called to the stage just like we are. So what advice do you have for those young performers that are suddenly going to be going to school, which may also be considered like being in public or have some stage fright attached to it? Like, wow, I'm all of a sudden in a classroom with 30 people, you know, and then I'm in front of an audience or in an audition room. What can we say to those young artists to help them through this time?
Yeah, my heart really goes out to them. You know, not only are our younger generations being diagnosed with anxiety and depression in just record rates, and that continues, I do think that there is a real sense of isolation even prior to the pandemic. You know, when all of us were in school, we didn't have to, if we weren't invited to a party, we might find out about it later on. But now, you know, a younger person can watch that party happening live and know
true.
That they're not invited, right? They can tune yes. into somebody's social feed and see that they are not there and everybody else is. So all of these just social pressures at that age are enormous to begin with. You know, who am I and what is my place in the world? How do I show up in the world is just kind of the identity stage that teenagers are at and you know, the younger college students too. And so now, of course, in isolation, we do see that a lot of people are feeling very lonely, very isolated. We know that this is not healthy for us. It's not good for us. Yet it's also dangerous to be out in public. You know, I suppose it remains to be seen. I don't want to, you know, assume the worst for this generation. But I think just being realistic that, yeah, these are challenges that prior generations have not had to cope with in the same way. So I'm assuming we are all around the same age, all of us. And, you know, I will never understand what it is like to be a teenager in these times right now, right? That was not my experience. My experience was very different. And so I think that hopefully that they can learn to have empathy for themselves as to why they maybe feel badly about certain things or feel afraid or feel anxious, and to know that that's normal and that the challenges that they are facing, nobody can give them advice on how to cope with this because nobody's been here before and nobody has been making that very important transition into adulthood. We call it emerging adulthood in these circumstances before. So I think, you know, finding an attitude of love and understanding towards oneself is so important. And then for all of the educators out there, having a lot of empathy for what they are going through and trying hard to put yourself in the shoes of what it is like to live in this social media generation. I think that, you know, first and foremost, we really do need more true connection. And social media, it is like the, you know, if we would maybe draw a metaphor between true connection and eating, you know, true connection would be like having a meal with all the four balanced food groups. And social media is like eating a bag of Doritos. You know, it sure, like it's calories, it scratches that itch, but it is not going to be a substitute for a balanced diet. So finding ways to balance that diet, and also, you know, realizing that they're living in the age of really, really quick and easy comparison, because you can tune into anything online. And I know this affects me when I am on my social media. Everything that everybody's putting out there into the world is so incredibly produced and curated and filtered. And there are some people who are showing up more real in online spaces. But I can only imagine, you know, thinking back to myself and my own journey into the college years and going into auditions, you know, being from a smaller state in a small city where I was definitely a big fish in a small pond, and then walking into you know, the waiting room at Manhattan School of Music to do my audition for my bachelor's degree, and looking around at, you know, probably 100 mm-hmm. other young people sitting in there, some warming up. They all seemed so much more worldly than me. They all seemed so much more advanced. And of course, this was filtered through the lens of my own insecurities and perceptions. But right, our younger generation tunes into that multiple times on a daily basis. So all of this to say, instilling healthy coping strategies in our younger generations as educators, and as the older generation, setting a good example for what healthy self-care looks like. And I think just, you know, reminding our younger generation that, I always love that quote, I'm not sure who it's from, comparison is the thief of joy. Mm. And when we are constantly comparing ourselves all day long on our social media to other people, it steals the joy really easily. I think it really dilutes our why. And yeah, so I wish I had sort of a cure-all suggestion for the younger generation, but I do think that this is a good question that you're both asking and will likely be a very real struggle as time progresses and as these younger generations enter school and enter the profession.
Yeah, I have to say, and Christine, I don't know if you agree with me, I had a physical reaction when you just mentioned watching, you know, not being invited to the party online.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my mm-hmm. goodness. I can't yeah. imagine what that's like nowadays to see video of, like, you know, Susie Q's birthday party and I wasn't invited. Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, I can yeah. feel it in my gut right now.
I know, it's yucky. It's yucky. And yeah. I think that there's not always the best awareness in the older generations. You know, we all sort of, you know, many people say, oh, social media is not good and it's not good for our young people. And they're also obsessed with it, as if it was some, you know, somehow their fault or something, right? But yeah. they, just the levels of exposure to other people and to also to, you know, bullying and feeling left out and feeling less than, it's enormous. And we never will understand what it is like to go through that in the same way at the same vulnerable stage of life.
Wow. Thank you for bringing all of that up and that awareness. I think we all have our own ideas and perceptions of what that must be like for our children. Honestly, I'm just hoping that my daughter's 5. I'm hoping that by the time she gets to an age that maybe social media just won't be around anymore and I can shield her from it completely. You know, I must admit I have that
You're
hope.
An optimist, Christine.
I am. I'm an optimist.
Well, just on that note, though, our children take their cues from us, right? So if a child grows up watching their parent constantly on their device, that normalizes that behavior. So I think the people out there who are more aware of their usage in front of their children or their teenagers, helping set up those healthy, that healthy modeling from a young age is incredibly powerful.
I'm very guilty of that. And I'm really glad you just brought that up. I need to get better at getting off my device, particularly my phone, in front of her. Thank you for bringing that up.
Sure.
Oh, so kind of moving on to the opposite as far as all of our colleagues and friends. I know during this time we might hear more and more who are very discouraged right now and have decided that maybe it's time for them to retire. They just can't see a way of making it back onto the stage, or just not knowing the timeline is very discouraging for them. Do you have advice for these performers? How can we encourage them to courageously take the stage again?
Yeah, I think that it's obviously a very personal decision. And I've been working, you know, privately with some clients right now who are deciding to leave the stage. And I'm helping them sort of walk through what life could look like post, you know, full-time performing. For most people who are in that position, who are debating their return, they have devoted just enormous time and energy and resources, and so much of their identity is wrapped up in being a performer that the idea of not going back is very scary, but the idea of going back is also very scary. Yeah. And I can totally see from the perspective of somebody who doesn't know how the industry will return and when, they have to put food on the table, right? So they have to decide, mm-hmm. is this the life for me anymore? Or is there something else that I could be doing with my life that would also be satisfying? So I think if I were working or when I work with somebody like that, I try to remind them that although the idea of taking a break or contemplating not going back feels very, very scary. That first and foremost, just taking a break doesn't have to mean that your career is over, right?
So true.
Yeah. We all get on this like merry-go-round of, oh, if I get off the merry-go-round, then everybody will forget about me and my career will be over, as if somehow all of the skills and everything that I've built over my whole life
goes out the window.
Exactly. Suddenly becomes totally irrelevant. But, you know, there is this fear of if I get off the merry-go-round, I'll never be able to get back on again. And while I won't, you know, we can't promise that it won't maybe be a little bit more difficult. The pause button has been pressed for everybody right now. You know, nobody is really performing in the ways that they want to be, maybe with the exception of some of our colleagues in Europe who have been able to go back to in-person performing. But I think that just allowing ourselves the space to contemplate, is this for me anymore? Could I give myself permission to take a break? And or if I do really want to go back, what are the new challenges that I'm going to be facing? And I think that what a lot of us do, which is a surefire anxiety provoker, is we tend to project into the future. Us humans, you know, we have this very advanced brain. And one of the things that our brain is so good at doing is trying to discern the future. So we spend a lot of time living there. And I think a lot of people probably, I know people that I talk to, and you know, I'll raise my hand here too. We get really focused on what's going to happen. How will it be? It'll be like this. It won't be like this. Just reminding ourselves that we can't predict the future. All we can do is take it one day at a time. And P.S., if our basic needs aren't covered right now, if we are really struggling financially, or we have health struggles or anything of the sort, maybe there's something going on in the family or in the home, it's really hard to pursue a performing career with all of those existential worries and fears going on in our lives. So I think just, you know, giving ourselves the grace to take a break if we want to. I mean, people don't have to return to the business if their heart isn't in it. There is life after performing, and very satisfying life after performing. It would definitely, you know, take some exploration of what could I do next. But I just would, I guess, use this opportunity to remind people that you may have to reinvent yourself, but life does go on. I, for one, am, you know, a person who reinvented myself in my early 30s, and life went on, and I'm very happy where I am now. And P.S., nobody can take performing away from you.
No, you'll always be a singer.
Exactly. Yeah. I will always be a singer. I will always find ways to sing. I still do. And I think having so much of ourselves wrapped up in this performer's identity, especially at a time like this, has made it really clear just how dangerous it is not to be a more well-rounded and well-balanced human who also takes pride in other aspects of their humanity and their abilities. So I guess all this to say, the people who do want to return, perhaps once again, getting really clear on the why and reminding ourselves that we can't predict the future. We can only just sort of cope with things one day at a time. And that we don't have control over anything but ourselves. So we don't have control about how the industry will or won't return, what it will look like in the future. We can only just, like I said, take things one day, one moment at a time. Maybe planning 1 week in advance might feel safe, but not, you know, we just won't ever be able to plan a, and we never were. We were never able to plan the entire future. We just thought we were. I think these people can strengthen themselves by speaking with their communities and finding comfort in the fact that everybody is going through the same thing right now, and it's very difficult and very painful. Maybe exploring other avenues if that provides them with some comfort. Here's what else I could do in the performing world that I could enjoy. Here's other attributes I have that I could explore, et cetera.
Right. And I just want to chime in and paint this picture for our listeners who maybe aren't in the performing arts. I hope that we have some out there. And I just want everyone to understand what it's like for us right now, you know, that we've devoted our entire lives and our schooling to this profession. And I'm getting emotional talking about it. It was just ripped out from under us. It was ripped out from under us, blindsided overnight. You know, all of us, we've abandoned our stuff in the dressing rooms. We've abandoned our sheet music, you know, in our practice rooms, abandoned our, you know, instruments and everything that we stand for. And there are so many people out there, like you said, who have children and have to still put food on the table, that maybe are even in their, you know, 50s and 60s, suddenly being forced to reinvent themselves in the world and find a new way to make a living. And going back to school or choosing a new profession at that age is not easy. It is not easy. But I like that you are saying that it's okay to think of it as a break, because our gifts are still inside us. They're still in our instrument, which is the whole body. We were born and trained with this gift. So to remind these people too, that you can come back.
It's interesting too, what can happen in a break. I mean, I, like Ingela, had a complete shift at 30 and transitioned into manual therapy. But at that same time, I was still performing 8 shows a week for another several years until I had my daughter. And once I had my daughter, people kept saying, do you plan on performing again, or will you go back to performing? And I kept, my answer was, yes, yes, I will. Yes, I will. And now people say, do you ever? And I'm like, I think so. Yeah, you know, but I'm transitioning, you know, my love, slowly as I was during this quote break, I actually started realizing that my love, my true passion, was for the voice and the study of the voice. Mm. My true passion is not actually performing. It's the love of the voice and everything around the voice. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm so incredibly fulfilled with what I'm doing with the visceral voice and with my manual practice and with all of you amazing artists and guests. But I didn't know that when I first started my break. I didn't know that my true passion was the study of it. So maybe I'll perform again, and maybe I won't. I'm pretty sure I will. I'm pretty sure both of my husband and I will. But sometimes during a break, you actually get clarity.
Well said.
That's another interesting aspect, and I appreciate you mentioning that. It's okay. You know, we need allowing ourselves to give permission to ourselves, take a pause, and just feel it out, see where we're guided.
Yeah, because sometimes we just don't have the choice, right? I mean, if we cannot go audition anywhere for any show that is happening, Well, I suppose we can produce online content, but everybody and their brother is doing that nowadays. And it feels like a very overwhelming, you know, strange way to show up as an artist in the world. Some people will find fulfillment there and turn it into something. But at the end of the day, our basic needs have to be cared for. But, I have faith in humanity and I have faith that art is absolutely necessary and that things will come back, but we just don't know how long and what the road will look like to get there. So all we can do is perhaps, use this as an opportunity, like you both said, to explore our other gifts and talents and abilities and to also view ourselves as more than just a performer. You know, we are way more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that there will be people on the other side of this table when we do go back to auditioning. Going back into the audition, the directors, the casting directors, all of these creatives. Kim.
I'm with you. I'm with you. No, I think what we're trying to say, it's we hope that they are sensitive to the fact that us as performers have not been in front of people in a long time. Yeah. And we may have some difficulties navigating the stage. So I think, Christine, what you're saying is what can we say to those creatives to help them understand what we performers are going through and that we may be a little rusty, you know, with the emotional aspect of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that this goes back to a larger problem that I know that you have both talked about before, which is that we are both expected to be infallible and we also have those expectations of ourselves. So, you know, both of you suffered in silence with your anxiety. I did. Many people do. I would say almost everybody who's performing at a high level does. If they are experiencing that, they don't go around advertising it to everybody. And why? Because we are afraid that we will then be harshly judged and rejected, that people will think we are, you know, I'm putting air quotes here, weak, or somehow damaged. And we are afraid that if we are honest about just, it's ridiculous, but just being human with human emotions, that we will never work again. And so I think that unfortunately there's a lot of stigma about talking about mental health in the performing community. And because we know how to show up confident, even if that's not how we feel inside, we have also then, you know, sort of been co-creators in this stigma of, don't worry, I've got it. I'm cool, calm, and collected. Everything is fine. So I can see that, you know, looking at that from the other side, people don't understand, you know, how often have you both had the experience in performing where you were suffering on the inside and then somebody said, oh, you just look so confident up there. And you're like, yeah, that's because I know how to act, right? It's called acting. But you don't know what it was like for me inside during that performance or during that moment. So yeah, it's only natural that people who don't do what we do maybe don't have the deep understanding of how it feels on the inside and how there's that disconnect between the inner experience and the outer presentation. So I suppose this would probably be a larger conversation, but already today by sitting here and talking about this, we are helping normalize mental health struggles in the arts, right? And how could we have ever considered that, you know, us performers would be anything than human? We are human and we suffer. So I would just hope that, you know, the creatives on the other side of the table, I would hope that this time in the pandemic has given us all a greater sense of empathy for ourselves and for one another and for just how difficult life can be for people. Because I doubt that anybody out there hasn't struggled more than usual during this pandemic. So I hope that we all come back to this with this, fresh take or different attitude on what it means to do the work we do and just what it means overall to be human and to struggle and to have difficulties. And I would guess that when people show up and perform again, if they have been coping with significant anxieties about other things in their lives, finances, health, you know, your own health, health of a loved one, whatever it may be, this may show up in our ability to perform. But, you know, there might also be the people out there for whom this pause was really rejuvenating. Mm-hmm. And maybe they were able to iron out some technical issues or work on their mental health, work on their stability, and who might be able to just show up and actually feel really good performing again. You know, I think I would just urge anyone to be kind. Be human. Yeah. And don't make the assumption that if somebody shows up and maybe they're a little rusty or haven't gotten their sea legs back yet, that will then continue to be a problem.
Yeah. And just to talk about their anxiety, maybe a little more openly. And I think that also goes with our mission here, is we want to demystify all of these issues that performers go through. And if I can just get on my little soapbox for a second, my performance anxiety got better once I openly talked about it and was confident to share it. Christine, do you agree? Do you feel like you had a better experience once you openly spoke about it in front of your castmates?
Yes and no.
Right.
If I talked about it with certain friends who had never experienced it, it actually made me feel worse.
Yes.
Like something was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I spoke about it with those who had experienced it and said, oh yeah, I have experienced that, then it gave me like, oh, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, the time that I was talking about my stage anxiety, no one was talking about vocal injury. No one was talking about injury at all. No one was talking about anxiety. You know, several actors now are coming out saying, I was so anxious for my opening of my Broadway show, you know, and they're really speaking out about that and they're normalizing the anxiety, which is so wonderful. But that wasn't happening when I was performing. So, I mean, your anxiety also happened a good 10 years after mine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when mine was happening, and I was talking about it, hardly anyone else was. So it sort of made me feel very isolated and alone, actually.
Yeah. I mean, going back to what I said before, and Ingela, you probably heard, I sought Christine out like secretly in Central Park one day. Mm-hmm. And I was like, help me, because I didn't feel like I could tell anybody about it. So I guess, Ingela, what I'm sort of getting at is, what do you say to performers who hide their anxiety? Are they actually making it worse?
Yeah, that is, it's a great question. It's maybe the million-dollar question, but you know, you both had different experiences doing this. I would say definitely, as you mentioned, affected also by the timeline of all of this and what is happening in greater society and how we are slowly destigmatizing mental health. It's funny to even say, you know, destigmatizing mental health, as if mental health is something that, like,
yeah.
Right? It's just health. It's just well-being.
Like, it's just living.
It's just called life, y'all. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. This is just the way it is.
Let's destigmatize being a human. Woo.
Oh, yay. I know, right? Oh my gosh.
Right. But within the, you know, performance community, I think that it happens similarly with people who maybe suffer from depression, that they might go to somebody and say, hey, I suffer from depression and I wanted to talk about this with you. And they might not get the reaction that they want or that they're hoping for. So I think being at first maybe judicious about how you share or to, you know, with whom you share this information, and also realizing, what is it that I hope to get out of this experience? And it sounds like, Christine, at the time you were sharing, I'm guessing, you can tell me if this is true, that you were hoping to get a sense of connection or feeling heard or seen, feeling like it's okay. And yes, I go through this too. Just that comfort in that shared experience. And you weren't getting that from some people, which I would also like to point out that, you know, just because somebody is not willingly admitting it, and maybe their experience wasn't the same as yours, that is, it's impossible that a human never experiences any fear or insecurity or anxiety. But, you know, I think a lot of people in the community have a vested interest and have built up really, really strong walls and never let anybody in on what their internal experience is, because, you know, for their own, what they think is their own personal sense of safety. But there is overall tremendous power in sharing and hearing that we are not alone in our experience, hearing that other people have been there or gone through it, or understand, or maybe even if they haven't, that they can offer us a sympathetic or an empathetic ear and say, wow, that must be really tough. And, you know, here's how fear has shown up in my own life. And maybe I haven't had exactly your experience. It takes a lot, you know, it's a risk either way. It's a risk to keep it secret. It's a risk to share it. But I do believe at the end of the day, we have more to lose from never sharing than we do by occasionally being rejected. So if I don't get the reaction I want when I share this information with somebody, keep searching, because there are people out there who will. And at the very least, you know, a trained professional, or maybe a trusted mentor or friend like Kimberly, you seeking out Christine in the park.
Yes.
So when we share, we release some of that internal pressure that has built up, and we also help get rid of some of the shame that we feel.
Yes.
And that, you know, that shame is such a difficult emotion for us humans to cope with. And shame grows when you hide it, right? It can become larger and larger the more we hide it. But shame will tell us that we shouldn't tell anybody, because it'll make the shame worse. And not to say that it occasionally won't, but I think overall we can help those feelings of shame through sharing in the right ways with the right people.
Yeah, I just want to say real quickly too to our listeners. Listeners, you have three people here, three people who you can openly talk to about your anxiety. So I would have to say, right, all three of us, that you can seek one of us out and talk about it, and we'll hear you. Ingle is the trained professional. But hey, at least these listeners have three people that they could maybe confess this to and talk about it, right?
Absolutely. And I would say, in hindsight of sharing about my anxiety as I was going through it, I would never take that back. I'm glad that I shared it. I'm glad I opened up about it. Exactly that example you gave, Kimberly, of you searching me out to talk about it. So me opening up about it at that time, then later on, I was able to be someone who could open my ear and listen, and whether it be friends, colleagues, or clients. So in hindsight, I absolutely would share it and share it and share it again. And now I'm very open about it. But even in the moment of when I was performing and the stage anxiety I was experiencing, I would share that experience again. So
yeah,
thank you.
It takes a lot of bravery to share any of that stuff with anyone, right? I sometimes work with clients for a while before they really truly open up to me. And, you know, I'm a trained professional. So it can be buried under a lot of layers, and there is a lot of fear. But it's important to take those risks, because I guess at the end of the day, do we truly even want to work for someone or with someone who is going to be so dismissive of our human experience? Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we could really transform an industry by showing up more authentically and by saying, of course, you know, I always joke with people that I work with, because what is one of the number one biggest fears of most of the general population? Public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And for a performer, right? If one of the biggest fears of everybody out there is speaking in public, and then thinking about what we do, it would be just completely cuckoo to think that we don't experience fear.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ingela, thank you so, so much for joining us for this second interview and helping to just kind of wrap our minds around what it could look like as we start getting hopefully closer and closer to being able to come back to auditions and to taking the stage. Thank you so much for being here with us. one more time, hopefully more, because I just love talking with you. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast and talk with us again. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, it's totally been my pleasure, and so good to connect with both of you, and to just feel like we're all out there, you know, fighting the good fight for people in our own ways.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with those you know. You can also like, rate, and write a review. Please feel free to check us out at www.theviscerovoice.com. You can also find me on Instagram or Facebook under The Visceral Voice. Please join me in 2 weeks for another wonderful conversation on The Visceral Voice.